Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
He's one of the most famous and celebrated generals in American history. Along with George Patton, however, he's also one of the most misunderstood and most mythologized. Douglas MacArthur, born in the 19th century, served in both World Wars, the Korean War, and in other less extensive U.S. military actions. He famously accepted the surrender of Japan in 1945 on the deck of the battleship Missouri. He oversaw its occupation by Allied forces, and he often gets credit for the reform and modernization of Japan, post-war Japan. Yet, he's also considered another attention hound like Patton, sometimes overly dramatic and often letting his overinflated view of his own abilities and destiny get in the way of sound judgment. Who was the real Douglas MacArthur? Well, we're going to find out, Buzzkillers, with Professor Phil Nash, who's with us here again in the Buzzkill Bunker. How are you, Professor?
Doing great, thanks.
Who was the real Douglas MacArthur? Should we start with his early life?
Start at the very beginning.
Why not? There's a long life involved. He was born, as I say, in the 19th century.
That's right. Like actually most senior American commanders in World War II, he's born in the 1880s or 1890s. He's born in 1880, and I would say sort of like Patton, even more so, sort of military life is sort of inbred. He is the son of the awesomely named Arthur MacArthur.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, Mr. and Mrs. MacArthur, you could have picked another name, but but that's just me. Arthur MacArthur, who was actually a Medal of Honor winner, Civil War hero, Missionary Ridge, life, career military officer, a senior military officer. Young Douglas graduates first in his class at West Point, 1903, first out of 93. He had one of the, you know, in terms of his point scores, he had one of the highest totals ever in U.S. history. So he was, he was not George Custer. He was a super, super sharp cadet.
Oh, so this is what people would call a GPA nowadays.
Exactly. And it was like, I think the third highest in all of U.S. history.
Wow.
So he was an amazing cadet. He was stationed in or traveled widely in the Philippines in particular, but also Asia. He was sort of his dad's assistant during this big sort of whirlwind tour of Asia. Thereafter, he works very hard to sort of style himself as an Asian expert. Later on, he's constantly claiming how no one understands the Asian mind like I do. There's really no reason to believe that.
Because he's always on tour with a...
Right. Did he know more about Asia than a lot of Americans? Yes. Than a lot of American generals? Yes. But that's not saying much. Right. And you know, he was actually did not know Asia very well at all. He knew the Philippines very well.
Right.
But actually seen very little of the rest of Asia, which is a very, very huge and diverse place, obviously. But
he didn't go to the mainland.
But a lot of people sort of just assumed that that was true. And when he was making a pronouncement about Asian policy or Asian strategy, everyone would sort of think, oh, well, it's Douglas MacArthur. He must know what he's doing.
So this goes all, but it does go all the way back to, would this have been the Spanish-American War?
A little bit after. Yeah.
Okay.
This is right. And in that war, of course, we acquire the Philippines,
right,
which long-term is a big strategic mistake. But he is I think has five different stints in the Philippines throughout his career. So yeah, obviously the Philippines is a huge part of his career and his identity. He takes part in the Veracruz expedition of 1914.
Now, what was that?
This was when Mexico was undergoing its very long and very complicated revolution, and where various times we intervene. We talked about this with Patton, where we sent troops into Mexico after Pancho Villa. This was actually a separate intervention in 1914 at Veracruz, basically intervening in Mexico's civil war. MacArthur, if you read about it, it's an amazing account. He goes off on this little mission with a couple of locals, and he's the only armed person, and they come under attack several times. And his bravery and recklessness are pretty insane. It's amazing he survived. I think he takes like three or four bullet holes in his clothing without being injured.
Oh, wow.
Personally kills a whole bunch of banditos. I mean, pretty badass, if I can use that term, on Professor Buzzkill.
Absolutely.
No question his bravery. He starts sort of like Patton, actually, at the same time.
Yeah. He
takes part in the 1916 expedition. World War One comes around, and he's rising steadily. In World War One, he's a brigade commander in the 42nd so-called Rainbow Division.
Okay.
And once again, very impressive performance. He brave to the point of recklessness. He is repeatedly gassed. And
so this is all taking on part on the Western Front.
On the Western Front in World War One, he rises to brigade command at the very end. He's actually a commander of the entire division briefly. Mm-hmm. He's wounded several times, multiple decorations.
Wounded several times.
Several times.
Wow.
Not serious wounds, but slight wounds.
He's
constantly, you know, and he's a pretty senior officer, right? He's a colonel, and then he's a brigadier general, and he's sort of leading patrols. He's very much. Very hands-on, aggressive, competent commander. I mean, from a military standpoint, I think if his career had ended here, I would have said he has a pretty good record. Wow. As we'll see later on, a little more mixed.
Yeah.
But this is often overlooked, and he deserves a lot of credit for his World War I performance. And then just rushing ahead, after World War I, he's briefly commandant at West Point in the early 20s.
Yeah. Now, I understand that he either put in reforms and got rid of hazing and all that kind of stuff at West Point. But that was that was hard to do.
A very hidebound institution. He tried to reform it, had mixed success. Partly, I don't think he was there long enough to put a lot of these. But there was a lot of resistance. And once again, from what I've read, I think he deserves some credit for trying to sort of modernize West Point, make it more useful. He wanted, for example, he had just been in combat a lot, so he wanted to make sure that what they were doing was more relevant. Not everyone was into that.
It wasn't just a military gentleman's finishing school.
Right. Exactly. Maybe we should actually train officers who know what they're doing on the battlefield. Yeah, who knew? Right, exactly. And then he moves to his first stint in the Philippines as commander of the Manila District in the mid-20s.
Oh, this is his first stint as himself, not just...
Right, not just sort of...
For his dad.
Right, yeah. Exactly. That's right. Keep in mind that this is in the interwar military. We talked about this in the Patton episodes. Very, very hard time to get ahead. One of the reasons he agrees to be commandant of West Point is that he gets to keep his... artificially high rank from the war, right?
You've got, because in the war you're often
right. You have your regular army rank and you have your brevet rank, right? Okay. And so during the war, the military expands artificially and you get a higher rank, and then during peacetime you downsize and you get your old rank. Well, you got to keep his new rank. And by the mid-20s, I think mid to late 20s, he's the youngest major general in the U.S. Army.
Oh, right. Okay.
And
he's that in the mid-20s, so that is young.
No. In the mid-1920s.
Yeah, sorry, Buzzkillers.
So he's like 45, but still, that's pretty young for a major general. Usually, that's a rank you get at the very end of your career when you're 60.
Wow.
65, not when you're 45. In any case, 1930, he's appointed chief of staff of the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. Pretty much, that's the plum job.
That's a Washington Post?
Yeah.
D.C. Post.
Yes, yes, a D.C. Post. But in that capacity, and this is the first major controversy in his career, he also presides over the clampdown on the famous Bonus March of 1932.
Oh, right.
This was a huge event of that year. About 10,000 World War I veterans had marched on Washington in an effort. It's the middle of the Great Depression, by the way.
Yeah.
In 1919, they'd all been promised a bonus, in other words, a bonus payment, but it was not going to be paid until 1945. Well, in a Great Depression, you want the bonus early. So they march on Washington. It's peaceful protest, but they're demanding early payment of the bonus.
Right.
The Hoover administration and Douglas MacArthur, they have no time for these demands. They don't like the idea that all these protesters are camped near the White House. A lot of conservative people like MacArthur and the Secretary of War, they are concerned that this is essentially a communist revolution waiting to happen.
Oh, really?
Which it was not.
Yeah.
In fact, later on, the Secretary of War, Patrick Hurley, when he writes about it later on, he talks about Camp Marx with an X.
Wow.
It turned out it was actually Camp Marx with a KS, named after some earlier soldier. Had actually nothing to do with Karl Marx. In any case, so this was an early case of sort of red scare-ism. Anyway, there are, long story short, the administration orders the army to sort of rout the marchers. They've already been defeated, by the way. The bill has been defeated in Congress. A lot of the bonus marchers are still lingering in town, and the government doesn't like it.
Okay, so the government doesn't cave into
No. They lobby Congress, and Congress does not vote the bonus to be paid early. Yeah, so they're defeated, but they don't leave town quickly enough. The protesters don't leave town quickly enough for the taste of the administration.
Right.
So President Hoover orders MacArthur to remove the protesters from the downtown area, but not he orders MacArthur not to cross into Anacostia and get rid of the camp there. Well, MacArthur, and not for the last time in his career, disobeys orders.
Oh, by the way, Anacostia is where in the...
That's in southeast D.C., okay. across from the capital, across the Anacostia River. So the Anacostia Flats is okay. Where the biggest encampment of the protesters was.
But Hoover wants them out of downtown, presumably because that's where they're more visible.
Right.
Leave them
alone.
Right,
and they're squatting. They're occupying some vacant buildings there, and... Yeah. It's very, very complicated. In any case, MacArthur basically disobeys orders. And by the way, on his staff at the time are people like Eisenhower and Patton.
As
junior officers.
They're both
present. And basically, in a pretty brutal fashion, including using tear gas that sets some fires in the camp, the army brutally ousts... And these are veterans, by the way. These are not just, these are people who served in the military, many of them in combat.
Not 1920s hippies.
No, indeed. And so, and basically it's MacArthur disobeying orders. Hoover, who's sort of a stand-up guy in an odd way, takes the rap for it.
Huh.
And even, turns out, lies about some of the details, which are then proven wrong on newsreels. And it's a horrible public relations disaster for the Hoover administration. One of the reasons why the Republicans are destroyed in 1932 by Franklin Roosevelt. It would have happened anyway because of the Great Depression. But in any case, it's not a good sign long term in terms of MacArthur's career. He's obviously already very full of himself, very much a prima donna, doesn't really take orders very well, does what he thinks is right, and would, you know, let someone else take the rap for it, that kind of thing.
Now, is there any evidence that he decided beforehand to try to clear everybody out, or was it when he saw the situation on the ground, he goes, well, I'm going to go ahead and
I think more the latter. Okay. I think he's basically decided that this is a threat, a serious threat, and regardless of whether the administration sees it the same way, I'm going to do what I think is right.
Okay. So he's still disobeying orders.
Exactly. He was ordered not to cross the bridge, and he did, with his troops and tanks, by the way.
Oh.
So then later on, he has his second stint in the Philippines, where by 1935, the Philippines is on its way toward independence, right? It had been acquired by the United States in 1899. It was not really a colony, more of a protectorate, I guess you could say.
Right.
It was annexed by the United States, but it's on its way to independence. They have semi-independence. They have a president, Manuel Quezon, and he now needs to build an independent Philippine army, and he hires Douglas MacArthur to lead the effort. He's named Field Marshal for the new Philippine army.
Now, maybe you don't know this, but this is a sort of odd thing to a non-expert. He's in the American military, and then he's also appointed...
Yes.
In the Philippine military?
Yes. Well, that's because the Philippines are not completely independent.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
And he does, at a couple points, he has sort of dual appointments. He has a U.S. military rank as an advisor in the U.S. Army, and also he has a Filipino rank as a field marshal in the Philippine Army.
Okay. And this is okay, Washington doesn't...
They were okay with it, partly because Roosevelt really wanted MacArthur to get out of Dodge. And the Philippines is a long way away.
Yes, particularly in that.
And maybe we can mention this now, because, you know, Roosevelt once famously said that there were only two people he feared. One was Huey Long, and one was Douglas MacArthur. There were doubts whether he actually said that.
Yeah.
He certainly was alarmed by Huey Long and Douglas MacArthur.
Huey Long, the famous agitator.
The agitator and Southern populist who conveniently for Roosevelt was assassinated in September 1935.
Oh, yeah.
And that same year, MacArthur is basically shunted to the Philippines, where he is really sort of out of FDR's hair.
Well,
basically.
There's a conspiracy theory for you.
Exactly.
Buzz, FDR gets rid of two
exactly. Coincidence.
In 1935.
Yeah, no, just so we're clear, no evidence at all that Roosevelt was...
MacArthur shot Long and then
exactly.
was exiled.
Pretty clever. In any case, so by the way, just parenthetically, MacArthur is richly compensated by the Filipinos. He is put up in... fabulous digs in the, I think it's the Hotel Manila, is paid an enormous, multiple enormous salaries. And at more than one point, early in World War II, he is given huge cash payments by the Philippine government, which sometimes are seen as bribes. And at least one of them was probably illegal under U.S. law, because at the time he was still a sort of U.S., had U.S. military rank and was taking these payments. They weren't really well known at the time. I suspect, this is just me speculating, I suspect partly this is so the Filipinos have their hooks in him.
In other words, which is one of the reasons behind a lot of bribes.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right. In other words, now he's always worried about, are we going to reveal this bribe that he took? And one of them was huge, like $500,000, which back then was an enormous sum. In any case, so he does not lack for resources in this period. In fairness to him, he's given a thankless task, right? He's supposed to build an army so that the Philippines can defend itself, and the Philippines really can't be defended, not by the United States and not by the Philippines. Right. Not when the threat is the Japanese Empire just down the road, as it were.
Is it because the Philippines politically is too weak, or is it because it's so many islands and it's so many ways to get in?
It's 3,000 islands.
Yeah.
Strategically, I would argue it was a mistake for the United States to have acquired it in the first place, because it's right on the doorstep of locally superior powers like Japan, and very hard to defend when it's 8,000 miles from the United States.
Sure.
In any case, in MacArthur's defense throughout this period, 20s and 30s, unlike a lot of Westerners and a lot of Americans, he apparently treats Filipinos as equals and treats them with a lot of respect. And I think this is one of the reasons why the Filipinos really dig him.
Yeah,
is that he is someone who treat, you know, a lot of, this is a very racist era, and of white Americans look down their noses at Asians of all sorts, or at best are paternalistic.
Yeah.
And he's not that way. Apparently he treats them as people and as equals, and he gets a lot of credit for that and deserves a lot of credit for that. 1937, he retires from the U.S. Army and then essentially becomes a civilian advisor to the Philippine government. In mid-1941, as war clouds are gathering, he is recalled from retirement by FDR to command the U.S. Armed Forces in the Far East, which is essentially the Philippine command of the U.S. forces.
Okay, so he's not yet the commander of all the Pacific.
Not yet. Okay. No, just in the Philippines. And it's pretty clear that war might start with Japan, and then here's where you get into trouble, because his plans – there was an original plan – or a more realistic plan that there's no way you can defend the Philippines. So what you do is you plan to sort of retreat to the Bataan Peninsula, which is this sort of small peninsula that helps form Manila Bay on the other side of the bay from Manila. Very rugged, very defensible. Plan to defend only that and hold out until you can be rescued by the U.S. Navy. That was the plan. Okay. He changes the plan. He says, no, we can defend all of Luzon. Which is the biggest island. Which is his. By the way, his forces. He has some U.S. forces, but they're very small. He has Filipino forces, which are new and basically untrained and unequipped. Mm-hmm. There's no way that any reasonable commander would say you could defend all of Luzon. That was a delusional plan, and it costs them when the war breaks out.
Okay, so this is something they're kind of talking about and preparing for before Pearl Harbor, but then after Pearl Harbor is the what they call the Philippines campaign.
That's right. Yeah, okay. And this is where once again MacArthur gets a lot of criticism, and I think he deserves it because Pearl Harbor's attack, December 7th, 1941.
Yeah,
because of the time difference, and because of the time difference in the Japanese attack, MacArthur and his people in the Philippines essentially get 9 hours of warning.
Oh, wow.
Which MacArthur fritters away.
Wait, 9 hours of warning that
in other words, they knew they had
Pearl Harbor's coming, or that the Japanese are coming out of the Philippines?
No, no, no. 9 hours between when they had news of the Pearl Harbor attack that had happened and they were at war with Japan. You have 9 hours to do something in case Japan attacks you in the Philippines.
Okay, gotcha.
In other words, the Japanese assault was not perfectly coordinated, not even close. And for example, he had his newly beefed up Army Air Forces in the Philippines, including brand new B-17 bombers. He had actually been, hours after the Pearl Harbor attack, had been ordered to launch an attack on Formosa, today Taiwan, which is a major Japanese base from which they launched their invasion of the Philippines. He had been ordered to attack. He disobeyed the order.
Oh,
and so when
when
the Japanese, and he sort of dithered, and he does not come out of this looking good at all. Long story short, even though he's had hours and hours of warning, the Japanese attack his forces and destroy half of his Army Air Forces on the ground.
Wow. 9 hours. So he had 9 hours to get the plane scattered.
A little bit less than that. I'd say maybe 5 or 6 hours, but still plenty of time to either obey orders and launch an attack on Formosa, or at least make sure the stuff's in the air and not caught on the ground. Now, big picture, I don't think it would have made a difference. The Japanese were overwhelmingly superior in the area. They would have captured the Philippines, so it's not like this swings the fate of World War II or anything.
Yeah.
But still, if your question is how good a commander he is, in this case, he's not very good at all. He disobeyed orders and he dithered, and then he basically got caught with his pants down. And one of his strongest assets was ravaged unnecessarily.
Right. The strongest assets meaning the Army Air Force.
The Army Air Forces. Yeah. And, you know, and they, throughout the Pacific War, early on anyway, we have this faith that B-17 bombers are great against ships, and they're not.
Oh, okay.
At Midway, they basically can't hit anything.
Yeah.
It turns out.
Well, it must be very hard to do.
It is very hard to do, but we had a lot of faith in our new wonder weapon, the B-17.
Yeah.
But in any case, the United States was going to lose in the Philippines. In any case, the Japanese, the question is how long it was going to take. Japanese attack Luzon. And because MacArthur had switched the plan, there is not this, all this stuff has not, supplies, material, ammunition, has not already just been concentrated in Bataan. It's spread all over Luzon. And so after the first couple of days, it's quite clear that they not only can't stop the Japanese invasion, they can't stop the Japanese from taking over all Luzon. So now they beat a hasty retreat to Bataan.
Okay.
And rather than a planned move to Bataan, it's sort of like this hasty retreat to Bataan. And the problem is then all the supplies or a lot of supplies were left behind. So the good news, bad news. They were able to bring most of their forces to the Bataan Peninsula and cause a huge headache for the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese planned to take all of Luzon in just a few weeks, and it turned out to take 4 or 5 months. But in any case, he had dropped the ball there. And then there's this famous defense of Bataan, which really is a pretty impressive military feat.
Yeah.
The Japanese ultimately conquer them, partly because, not just because of combat, because of disease. A lot of Filipino and U.S. troops fall to disease, and they have limited medical supplies. A lot of them are malnourished.
That supply problem you're talking about before. Yeah.
That's right. His headquarters is in this sort of small fortress island right off Bataan called Corregidor, which people may have heard of. That's where his headquarters is. Here's where MacArthur gets his reputation as Dugout Doug.
Yeah.
And that is a little unfair. It's true he only visited Bataan once.
Mm-hmm.
And as a senior commander, he was not big on sort of, not like Patton, for example, not sort of leading from the front, big on visiting the troops and establishing a bond with them. But he did certainly suffer privation, and he was certainly under fire. Many times in World War II, he's under fire and sort of almost reckless with his behavior as a senior general. So you can never, ever call him a coward. And that's why I think Dugout Doug thing is a little unfair.
The Dugout Doug thing implies
that he's always in his bunker.
Right, and too afraid to come out.
That's right.
Okay.
Which is, like I said, is unfair. I think where this comes from is a lot of the troops are starting to detect the gap between the reality and the press releases that come from his headquarters.
Oh, okay.
And you're going to see this throughout World War II, and even after World War II and during Korea, the press releases come from his headquarters are, you'd think he was sort of military Jesus, you know, walks on water. Anything good that happens is because of him.
Oh, right.
More so than most releases from headquarters, it's not, well, we'll talk about this later, it's not we or us, it's I do this, MacArthur did this.
Wow.
A lot of them are written by him himself. To his discredit. In other words, I think when it comes to public relations, he micromanages.
Wow.
Because he is obsessed with burnishing his image. And I think that rubbed a lot of his troops the wrong way.
And the soldiers they realized what was going on pretty quickly.
That's right. Yeah. And it's really.
Must piss them off if they're the ones who are doing the work.
That's right. And so Dugout Doug is accurate to them in the broader sense of things. And by the way, later on, a lot of people in the United States who are huge MacArthur fans, a lot of them, including very prominent like newspaper publishers and politicians, they're struck by how when they talk with soldiers and sailors on leave from MacArthur's command, they don't have very nice things to say about him.
Oh, wow.
And they're like, wow, what's up with this? But how could they say this? And then there are even some of them who theorize, well, only the anti-MacArthur troops are being sent home on leave. Which is, no, that's not how this works. No, maybe you should question your own assumptions about the general.
Backwards justification.
Exactly. But there was a huge gap there. And once again, contrast with Patton, right? As I may have said last time, a lot of people said, oh, I was with Patton's army. Very few people after World War II say, I was with MacArthur's army.
Oh,
as far as I understand. And so, his popularity is much more a domestic thing than a on the ground with the troops thing.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So the United States does, unlike, say, British Commonwealth forces in Malaya and Singapore, which are humiliated by an inferior Japanese force very, very quickly. It was ahead of schedule for the Japanese.
Right, right.
The Bataan campaign sets the Japanese back in their time frame of conquest.
Oh, okay.
And it really is an impressive defense. MacArthur actually is not there for the last month or two because he is ordered out. Roosevelt orders him out, or Roosevelt believes that he's not useful as a POW.
Right, yeah.
Since obviously it's a question of when, not whether they're going to lose. And so he is whisked out of the Philippines and taken to Australia so he can command the new Southwest Pacific area.
Right.
He'll be in command of all forces there. When he leaves, he famously announces, I shall return.
That's probably his most famous quote.
One of his most famous things, and we'll talk about this, it's not we shall return, it's I shall return.
Oh, right, right, yeah.
And in fact, the brass in Washington actually, because this was an official statement, in Washington they actually asked him, could you change the I to we, please? And he refused.
Wow.
Which is kind of interesting. And I thought it was interesting. This became sort of a joke among some of his soldiers. And for example, more than one soldier would say, I'm going to the latrine, but I shall return. Which is kind of mean, but you can imagine why they would do that.
Yeah. But GI humor is usually pretty good.
Yes, it is. It's some of the best. But here's the key, and if people are wondering, okay, if he's not such a great general, why does he have this reputation, and why does he develop such political clout?
Yeah.
Important thing is the context. Context is early 1942, we are basically getting our butts kicked across the Pacific. All right. The news is bad.
Mm-hmm.
American forces are being defeated all over the place. The only good news, apart from possibly the Doolittle Raid of April 1942, where we bomb...
The first bombing of
actually bombed Tokyo. Apart from that, there's no good news. And it seems like no one's fighting the Japanese except Douglas MacArthur.
Oh, right.
So he is lionized in the American press. Now, partly this is a lot of right-wing edited newspapers that are pumping him up because they want him to challenge Roosevelt for the presidency later on, right? They want to create a war hero.
Right.
But in reality...
This would be the 1944 election.
Right.
Yeah.
In reality, there is no other American senior commander who's fighting the bad guys anywhere. Not against Germany, not against Japan, right? This is months before we land in North Africa.
Yeah, okay.
To fight against the Germans. So we're suffering all these defeats. We want a good story. And so the media has sort of nonstop coverage of MacArthur's every little doing. Remember, there's wartime censorship.
Yeah.
So a lot of this reporting is based heavily on his press releases.
Wow.
And Americans, as one Walter Borneman, who is writing a new book on MacArthur, as he points out, people not only wanted to believe this, but Americans also loved sort of the lone wolf, right? The one guy standing up against overwhelming odds. We always loved that story in our culture, and MacArthur seemed to fit that bill. And so after this, his reputation snowballs. He becomes lionized. People idolize him back in the United States. A lot of powerful sort of movers and shakers on the right see him as their political savior later on. Mm-hmm. And he gets this reputation for being the best commander ever. And that very quickly takes a life of its own. And then presidents and his superiors in the military, he becomes sort of untouchable to them.
Wow.
And even though they have their doubts about him, he's insubordinate repeatedly.
Yeah.
He's constantly whining about not getting supplies. He constantly disagrees with strategy. They feel like they have to put up with him because he's got such political strength in the United States. To me, that would be
the media has already built this
and,
thing.
And then it takes on this life of its own. I think to me that would be my thesis here. It's like, how do we explain the sort of MacArthur phenomenon and the gap between sort of performance and reputation? I think this is where it comes from.
Oh, no kidding.
It is 1942.
Oh, so the idea is that the American media is building up this image of him, even though what's going on the ground and in the islands is not what's actually happening.
Right. It's much more complicated. And if you knew his actual performance, you'd be appalled. If you knew how much this was the product of public relations and not reality, you'd be concerned. Very quickly, he surrounds himself with nothing but yes men.
Right. But by the way, is he still in Australia at this time, or is he starting to go back towards...
No, he's still in Australia. And okay. I remember, in the early days of 1942, after the fall of the Philippines especially, Australia is sort of the front line.
Yeah, which is amazing. No one ever thinks about that.
In terms of strategy, for the United States, preserving the sort of lines of communication between the United States and Australia, that's in the name of the game. If you can't do that, you might lose the war in the Pacific. And the Japanese, they bombed Darwin, which is a town on the north side of Australia. They threatened Port Moresby, which is on the southern side of New Guinea. Mm-hmm. Only the Battle of the Coral Sea in May sort of checks the Japanese advance. So it is the front line, and he's put in charge of what at the beginning is not very much in terms of forces, certainly not American forces. In fact, a lot of people know this. Early on, the bulk of his forces are Australian.
Oh, okay.
And that's also a real tense relationship. He is asked, for example, to put people of many nationalities, including Australians, on his staff, and he refuses. So, and that's just a bad idea, right?
Yeah,
you know, your staff is entirely American. Most of your troops are Australian. That's not very savvy. Eisenhower would never have done that.
Yeah.
But at least he doesn't worry about those sorts of things. And later on, by the way, later in the war, he's going to completely freeze Australian forces out of things like the Philippines,
which
also rankles in Canberra and Sydney. So he's responsible for the SWPA, the Southwest Pacific Area, in defense of Australia. Then he sort of takes charge of essentially his return to the Philippines.
Okay. The return part of I Shall Return.
In a way, his I Shall Return he's sort of attached his credibility to that. And so now he has to make true on it, whether it makes strategic sense or not.
Oh, right.
Now, in fairness, all senior commanders think that their theater or their command is the most important ever.
Yeah.
He takes that to an extreme. The rest of the war really doesn't exist. To him, the center of the universe is Asia. And the center of that Asian universe is him reconquering the Philippines, because that's what's going to defeat Japan. I think most historians would agree that that was an unnecessary duplication of effort. In other words, from Australia, going through New Guinea, then to the Philippines.
Yeah.
Strategically, the Central Pacific campaign, in other words, you island hop from the Gilberts to the Marshalls to the Marianas to the Bonins to the Ryukyus.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If you know
the Japanese mainland.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. If you know your Pacific island chains. In other words, small islands that can be taken with much less effort than retaking the Philippines, for example.
Okay.
And use each of these islands as a base from which to, well, first of all, you're circumventing the strong Japanese positions.
Right.
And use each new island as a base from which to attack the next island. That way you close in on Japan, bring Japan within range of your bombers, and then ultimately prepare for, well, as it turns out, either an invasion or dropping of bombs, large and small.
Yeah. So what you're saying is most military historians think that he should have sort of done an end around and
no, I would say most historians would have said that he should have recognized strategic reality and agreed to be second fiddle to the Central Pacific campaign under Nimitz. Now, partly this is on FDR. FDR has got these two competing campaigns, and he refuses to decide. He doesn't pick one.
He
decides to go with both. And partly this is politics. This is partly FDR believing, rightly or wrongly, that that MacArthur is untouchable, that if you detract from MacArthur's campaign in any way, you're going to pay a huge political price at home. So you give MacArthur what he wants. The New Guinea campaign and the Philippines campaigns are very, very costly.
Yeah.
Now, with the Philippines, it's complicated because on the one hand, the Filipinos were certainly looking to be rescued from Japanese occupation, right? In other words, it's very easy in retrospect to say to them, oh, you just should have waited till the end of the war for liberation. On the other hand, the Philippines suffered mightily in the reconquest of the Philippines, including people in Manila, where the loss of life was enormous. The Japanese went down, as they always do, very, very hard, and they massacred a lot of civilians in the meantime, all of which would not have happened, presumably, without an invasion of the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, invasion of the Philippines, prior to the invasion of the Philippines, we attacked islands because of MacArthur, like Peleliu, which, if any of your buzzkillers have seen the HBO series The Pacific, which is sort of the Band of Brothers for the Pacific, which I highly recommend.
Yeah.
It's very well done. We'll put it
on the Buzzkill bookshelf and also links to it.
I highly recommend it. It focuses on a couple of episodes on the reconquest of Peleliu, which was this godforsaken place with an unbelievable cost to the American Marines. And a lot of historians believe it's completely unnecessary.
Wow.
And it's partly because of support this, I would argue, unnecessary campaign in the Philippines.
Huh.
But, you know, obviously politics always intrudes in every war, and this is no exception. But throughout this time, MacArthur, once again, shows a lot of bad decisions. He, toward the end of the New Guinea campaign, he decides he wants to attack head-on the Japanese base at Rabaul, which was basically a fortress. It was one of the large, strongest Japanese outposts in the entire Pacific.
Right.
And island-hopping doctrine would suggest that you go around such a base and cut it off, which is, and ultimately, the good news is ultimately that's basically what they do.
Yeah.
They don't attack it front-on. But what kind of a strategist would not realize that was a preferable way to go as opposed to attacking it head-on?
So what year are we talking about now?
This is 43-44.
Okay.
So early 43, they start to counterattack and push the Japanese. By the way, it was the Japanese who chose to campaign in New Guinea, and it ended up costing them like 100,000 troops.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And so it was very painstaking. They sort of gradually drove the Japanese back. The Japanese, of course, very staunch in defense.
MacArthur's coming up from the south, so to speak, and Nimitz is coming in from the east.
Correct. Right. Those are the two main thrusts. Both basically headed toward Japan. MacArthur's path is basically Australia, New Guinea, Philippines,
mm-hmm.
and based in Pearl Harbor. Nimitz's thrust is, like you say, east to west through island chains.
Right.
Ultimately, basically Tarawa, Saipan, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa.
Right, right.
That's basically okay. That's his thrust. Now, by the way, the two, like when it comes to invading the Philippines in late 1944, the two campaigns cooperate.
Right.
McNamara. Why keep screwing up names? Old age. MacArthur has to rely on carrier based aircraft for the invasion of the Philippines, so Nimitz has to cooperate with him. But so he in October 1944, they invade the island of Leyte.
Yeah, right.
And he gets to wade ashore, an event which is staged twice because the cameras didn't do it right the first time.
The famous film clip we see is the second.
Yeah, well, isn't that also true of the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima? Don't they do that twice?
No. Well, they actually, I don't know. We did a show on that. Now I've forgotten.
Uh-oh, sorry.
That's all right.
We'll leave aside Iwo Jima. It's not the first time that things are staged twice for the cameras. But, you know, his landing craft gets sort of hung up, and so he has to wade in through sort of knee-deep water.
Yeah.
But they don't do it to his satisfaction, so it has to be done again so the cameras can get it right. And so he wades ashore, and he declares that I have returned.
Yep.
Not, you know, who knew he took down the Japanese single-handedly? None of his troops had anything to do with it. By the way, he does have some very good junior commanders.
Yeah,
people like his army commander Eichelberger and his Air Force commander George Kenney. They're very, very good. But in terms of his staff, including his intelligence chief and his chief of staff, a lot of these people are either marginally competent or incompetent, and they were chosen because they are reliable yes men.
Right.
They
do
exactly. They never question his orders. They never present him with contrary evidence. He's got his own intelligence operation, a sort of renegade intelligence operation, which is not very good.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's a lot of the times when in World War II, when he has successes, often they're luck. They're in spite of his best efforts, not because of his best efforts. I know that sounds overly negative, but I think it's true.
Well, and it's interesting how there aren't, you know, junior commanders under him who might be interested in pushing the old man out. But you can't do that because, or at least Roosevelt and the boys can't do that back in D.C. because of this domestic reputation
that's
been built up.
And once again, everyone in the military and out of the military, they either believe the hype,
right?
And so if I question him, I'm wrong.
Uh-huh.
Or they either know he's untouchable, or they think he's untouchable. In other words, we don't know what happens if you go up against MacArthur because nobody did. Right? We would know what if Roosevelt had said, you know what, this is a needless waste of resources. You're playing second fiddle to Nimitz. We don't know what would happen in that case. Everyone just assumed that they would blow up in your face. We don't know that.
Right.
Right? In other words,
because they were too scared to do it.
Right. They were too scared to do it. Wow. So, I mean, the end result is the same. But the question is, you know, was his reputation for political power as great as it should have been? I don't know. We'll never know. It became the sort of, had a life of its own.
Okay, so the reconquest of the Philippines has taken place, and this is
late 44, into early 45,
right?
At great cost, like any place else, at much greater cost to the Japanese,
right? Yeah,
because they refuse to surrender. But there's huge devastation in the Philippines, huge civilian loss of life, huge loss of American lives and Filipino military lives in this campaign. Which, if you think it's unnecessary, then that's not a good aspect of his record.
That's a lot of blood on your conscience.
In any case, the decisive campaign in defeating the Japanese is not the Philippines. It just isn't. It's the island hopping campaign. It's okay. Saipan, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. Saipan already mid-1944 brings us within bombing range, because we have our B-29s, within bombing range of Japan. We start to systematically destroy their cities. We talked about this earlier.
So what is MacArthur doing between the reconquest of the Philippines and the end of the war, if you will?
He's overseeing the conquest of the Philippines. By the way, he insists on liberating all the islands. Including the southern islands.
And there are zillions of them.
And a lot of them have Japanese forces on them, where they always fight. Almost always fight to the last man.
And that must be considered also a tremendous waste.
And this is why, I don't know, maybe some of your older buzzkillers will remember this. In the 60s and 70s, every so often there's a news story about how some individual Japanese soldier is found. He still thinks the war is going on. As late as 1974, they come across these ancient Japanese soldiers who have been told to defend this patch of land, never receive any contrary orders. And they're found, old and gray, and their uniforms are in tatters, but they don't know the war is over.
They're holed up in caves.
Hold up in caves, when people tell them, by the way, the war's been over for 30 years, they don't believe it.
Yeah.
There are some cases where their former commanding officers are trotted out to convince them to surrender.
Yeah, I've seen clips of that where they're trying to broadcast up into these caves on big speakers.
Absolutely insane. Yeah. So, that gives you an idea of the tenacity of the, to put it mildly, of the Japanese defense.
Right.
And once again, that to me, that's an argument for circumventing islands rather than conquering them.
Right.
Even like in the southern Philippines, by the time you've taken the northern islands, they're all cut off. They're no longer a threat to you.
Between you and Australia.
So. Why are you doing this? Unless you're convinced that you need to further build your image as liberator of the Philippines.
Wow. But you already are liberator of the Philippines, in effect.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
In any case, so by the summer of 1945, he's involved in the planning of, we've mentioned this before, Operation Downfall, which is invasion of Japan itself, which is planned for November 1945 and March 1946. He would command that.
Okay. Oh, he would command that over Nimitz, not Nimitz.
The ground forces, yes.
Okay.
Gotcha. So the actual amphibious forces that land, the soldiers and Marines, he would have commanded that. But happily, the war ends mid-August 1945. He presides over the famous surrender ceremony aboard the USS Missouri.
Now, why is he chosen for that and not Nimitz?
Good question. They're all there, by the way, and I mean...
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, Nimitz is there. Even liberated generals like Wainwright, who was the guy who was left behind in the Philippines, and Percival, who was the British commander in Malaya and Singapore, they are sort of, and they're still skin and bones, by the way.
Ugh.
They're sort of brought out of prisoner of war camps, and they're given uniforms, and they're present. By the way, if buzzkillers ever go to Hawaii or go to Pearl Harbor, they've preserved the USS Missouri. You can go and stand on the spot where the where the surrender took place. It's an amazingly small area. In any case, so yeah, he is appointed.
Was there the idea that MacArthur has gone through? He's gone through such a tough time conquering the Philippines. He's put in the blood, sweat, and tears in the Pacific all this time. He's the one who should be the figurehead on the deck of the Missouri, not Nimitz.
That I don't know. I'm, once again, doing the bad thing and speculating. But I suspect that you've got to pick somebody.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And, like you said, who's got greater clout? Who has more prestige, a better reputation, MacArthur or Nimitz? Nimitz is well-known, too.
Yeah.
But no one in the Pacific War, no one has a name like MacArthur. So if you're the Roosevelt administration or if you are the top brass in the Pentagon, he's the obvious choice. And we're already, if you're noticing, we're already following this pattern that if anything big happens in the Pacific, you feel like you have no choice but to name MacArthur. We're going to see this at least twice more.
Right.
And the question is that really true? Right. It was sort of the untested presumption. Assumption, right? We have to put him in charge. He's king of the Pacific. Who else, right? If you don't name him commander of the invasion, or if you don't name him the person who oversees the surrender, who do you name? And then people will be asking, how come you didn't pick MacArthur?
Yeah.
So it's just easier, right? It becomes the path of least resistance.
But then
it becomes the default.
By doing that, you're also adding to this image.
Correct.
He can then take that back in 1945 and run
you're
office.
All you're, in terms of like people like Roosevelt and Truman, all you're doing is basically you are postponing the inevitable showdown.
Wow.
And the showdown's going to be much worse later on than if you had nipped this in the bud. And by this, I mean his sort of insubordination and putting him in his place.
So he ends World War II effectively not only as a conquering general or reconquering general of the Philippines, but also as a conquering general of American public opinion. He is the most famous person in the Pacific. He's, along with Eisenhower, he's the most famous general to come out of the war.
My guess is, if you were to poll Americans in 1945, who do you think won the war in the Pacific? I think most would say MacArthur.
Wow. But most experts would say Nimitz.
Well, they would say Nimitz. Well,
they would say the army.
The army, or in other words, it was a collective effort. They would say it's the people at home too. But, you know, once again, in terms of people's especially back then, people's understanding of history as it's being made, people understanding of how events take place, so like what moves history. People like Harry Truman would believe it's great individuals doing great things.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why still biography is so popular among the public, but not popular among professional historians.
Right. Right.
And so if you ask people who's the great man in the Pacific War, who brought the great Japanese Empire to its knees, they would say MacArthur.
And that would be an amazing crowning achievement for someone like him. But of course, he goes on later on.
Absolutely. The story's only half told.
Yeah. And Buzzkillers, we're going to go on for a second episode next week because the big Douglas MacArthur will not go away. Talk to you then.
Peppercast.